WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're saying happy 100th birthday to one of the most popular American composers of the 20th century, Richard Rodgers.
Oh, Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain.
June is busting out all over.
All over the meadow and the hill.
Buds are busting out of bushes and the romping river pushes every little wheel and wheel beside a mill.
I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair and send him on his way.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8. She likes the theater, but never comes late. She never bothers with people who she hates. That's why the lady is a tramp.
For more than six decades, Richard Rodgers, teamed as Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein, was the romantic master of popular song and musical theater. His music, with its soaring melodies and bittersweet lushness, captured the American heart in more than 40 musicals and 900 songs. With lyricist Lorenz Hart, he filled the American songbook with standards like Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered, The Lady is a Tramp, and This Can't Be Love. With Oscar Hammerstein, he created a new theatrical form, the musical drama, in which characters and story were as important as a good tune. 100 years after his birth, Oklahoma is back on Broadway. Jazz singers still keep his songs at the top of their repertoire. And his music defines a romantic American vision of the 20th century, the American century. To celebrate Richard Rodgers' 100th birthday, I met with Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, whose new CD, My Favorite Things, A Richard Rodgers Celebration, is a collection of 13 of his favorite Richard Rodgers compositions. Keith Lockhart, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
And here we are talking about the centennial of Richard Rodgers' birth, the music that is just in the air of almost every American's life. Maybe especially it's associated with childhood still today in some way. Do you remember in your youth when you first stumbled into Rodgers, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Richard Rodgers?
Well, I think a lot of people of my generation stumbled into it the same way, and that was through their last, some people say their greatest musical, but the one that's closest to resonance with me, of course, is Sound of Music.
The Hills Were Alive.
Exactly.
All of a sudden. You must have been grade school.
Well, when the show came out, I wasn't born yet, actually, but the movie came out when I was considerably younger than that. But then, of course, it became a staple of every year on TV. You'd see Julie Andrews twirling around on the top of that hill. Mm. And I think that's probably the first score that entered our minds. And, you know, these pieces, it's amazing, not just The Sound of Music, but back through Rodgers and Hammerstein and into Rodgers and Hart, there are so many of his songs that are in our blood. The things that I, to some embarrassment, I didn't even know that Richard Rodgers wrote Manhattan until I started to do
How do they get into our blood? Here, you spent a life in music. Do you recall marching through these musicals video by video or performance by performance? Or is it elevator music? Is that how it got in your blood, walking in a mall?
Well, I think it's probably all of the above. In my case, I was and still am a real music theater junkie. I've always loved the Broadway musical. It's been something that I was heavily involved in professionally, and I did rent all the videos, and I did see pretty much from the movie versions first. I think there's still a good number of Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals that I've never seen on the stage, but I've experienced them as in Technicolor.
There's so much we're going to talk about this hour, but give us, if you would, your sense of what it is at the heart of Rodgers' work, with Hart, with Hammerstein, that defines almost today something about sentimental America in this music.
Well, Rodgers had an amazing career. It's a 50-year career on Broadway, from 1926, his first successful show, into the mid-1970s, you know, 15 years after the death of Oscar Hammerstein. There is a resonance with things American and things that changed in America over that period of time. In the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, which is certainly where we know most of the songs that we all know today come from those shows, there was a new definition of the Broadway musical and an attempt to take on subjects that were serious and that were close to Americans' hearts. And, you know, prior to these shows, musical theater in many ways was a fairly surfacey a superficial sort of entertainment, books that were very weak and just designed to connect a number of songs, even wonderful songs, Cole Porter songs together. Rodgers and Hammerstein really invented the concept musical in many ways, which is what brought on, you know, the Stephen Sondheims of today, taking on serious subjects, taking on things like Oklahoma, which really has, it feels like there's a deep resonance into the kind of myth of America, the frontier and the conflicts that we've solved, to racial prejudice in South Pacific, to domestic abuse, essentially, in Carousel. They weren't afraid to take on a lot of things that people thought were not seemly subjects. And I think, therefore, there's an honesty that has resonated with us since then.
Stack Richard Rodgers up against other great American composers, Aaron Copland, choose who you will. How big a piece of the pie of Americans' musical sense of themselves and the nation do you think Rodgers, at the end of his work, can claim?
Well, there's really only two musical art forms that you can really claim are quintessentially American, that are native to our culture. They are, of course, jazz, which everybody talks about as an indigenous American art form. And the other I would make an argument for is the Broadway musical. Of course, there are connections to the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan and Offenbach and Strauss and Lehar, but there is something very, very unique about that that has since translated back, which is what has brought us Andrew Lloyd Webber and all the other back across the pond sort of resonances. I think that the only thing that puts Rodgers into just one camp of all this is that he was a theatrical composer. He, by his own admission, he was only inspired by the concept of setting words to music. There's very little attempt of Richard Rodgers to write concert music. There's the score to Victory at Sea, for instance, but that, even that was intended to serve a dramatic function. He was a composer of dramatic music. But on the other hand, he knew what he did best, and he did it best.
But I guess I'm curious about what share of the American musical heart he has a claim on. You're a conductor. You stand before orchestras, and you pull them up, and you, the music comes forth. You must be feeling the audience. When you play Richard Rodgers' tunes, what's the response of the audience compared to anything else you play?
It's amazing. We did a little event, me playing piano and a couple of local singers singing some of the favorite songs. It felt very much like a fireside chat sort of thing. It wasn't the big orchestra thing with the darkened hall.
Right.
There were a few hundred people gathered around. And the look on, in people's eyes and the fact that people are mouthing words or openly singing along to everything. There is no other composer. I mean, all the great songwriters. Maybe George and Ira Gershwin would have gotten that kind of response. But no other single, Hoagy Carmichael, any of the Johnny Mercer, any of the really worthy songwriters who could have gotten that response on every single song we picked. And it is part of what people consider their cultural birthright is the music of Richard Rodgers.
Me, a name I call myself, Bob, a long, long way to ride. So I made a pudding pen, long, on milk with mama's heart, tea, a drink of jam and bread.
To mark the centennial, the Boston Pops have come out with My Favorite Things, the Richard Rodgers Celebration. Is it 13 songs from the Rodgers work of 900 songs? How on earth did you choose these 13? What's in here and how did you select it?
Painfully, actually. It was a really difficult project. It took, I think, the better part of a year to figure out what we were going to do, because you're looking at this going, all right, we have 65 minutes of music here. Just the Rodgers and Hart repertoire is over 600 songs. Where do you start cutting things down? The other thing, of course, is this is primarily an orchestral album. And we do have, as you know, Martina McBride joins us, Jason Danieli and Colin Ray to sing, because it is such a vocal tradition, you can't get away from that. But basically, it's an orchestral album. So it was also things that translated well, that worked without words attached to them, I guess, is the operative thing. And we tried to balance the plate between things that everybody knows, those greatest hits of Richard Rodgers, and a couple of things that we think people should know. I think my very favorite thing on the album is a wonderful orchestration of his ballet Slaughter on 10th Avenue, which is from the 1936 Rodgers and Hart musical On Your Toes. Has the distinction of being the first Broadway musical to ever contain a complete set ballet in its context, and it was designed to be choreographed actually by a young emigre choreographer named George Balanchine, whom I'm told did rather well after this, but this is a point he was a relative unknown.
So
and the original show orchestrator, one Hans Bialik, who did most of Rodgers' shows in the 1930s, was asked by Paul Whiteman to do a specific orchestration for the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Now, this is very similar to the original version of Rhapsody in Blue. It's a tight, small jazz orchestra sort of sound. It's not the big, squishy 1950s sort of orchestration we expect. We dug this out of the archives at Williams College, where the Paul Whiteman archives are. Hadn't been recorded, as far as we can tell, since Whiteman recorded it in 1937. Restored the parts and recorded it, and I never want to do any of the other versions again. It's so spectacular in that version, and I think so true to that kind of tight, taut 30s sort of approach to things.
Musicians rise to this music, or is it, oh my gosh, it's so syrupy, it's so sentimental, don't take us back there.
No, the thing is, these were a lot of the Rodgers and Hammerstein material, for instance, is in the original orchestrations by Robert Russell Bennett, who was the great orchestrator of the 40s, 50s, 60s on Broadway. And his orchestration, his craft is so good that these pieces really haven't aged, and they're still fun to play. And from a musical significance point of view, this music still means a lot to the orchestra, and it's fun to play with.
Keith Lockhart, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation Ted Chapin. He's president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Foundation. Welcome, Ted Chapin.
Well, thank you.
Ted Chapin, talk to us about Richard Rodgers' early years. Where did he come from? Was it a musical family? How did he get on this amazing path?
Well, he came from a family of doctors for the most part, but they were good New Yorkers who liked going to the theater. And he was taken to the theater at an early age and apparently, you know, climbed up on the piano stool in the parlor of the house on 120th Street and, you know, plunked out tunes that he had heard in the afternoon at the theater. And I guess his parents thought, gee, I think there's something in him. And he just kept playing and, you know, kept going to the theater. And as soon as he saw what purported to be a musical in those days, he said, I want to do that, and offered himself to anybody who wanted a composer. And at age 16, his brother was at Columbia University. Actually, interestingly, there were two guys at Columbia. First was a guy named Oscar Hammerstein, with whom they wrote a couple of eminently forgettable songs. And then he hooked up with Larry Hart, who was another Columbia University student. And
Larry, a.k.a. Lorenz.
Lorenz Hart, yeah, absolutely.
They went on to write Babes in Arms, On Your Toes, The Boys from Syracuse, Pal Joey. What change did Rodgers and Hart bring to American musical theater?
Well, I think, as Keith pointed out, the Slaughter on 10th Avenue was the kind of innovation that they did, because they decided that, you know, they would put a ballet in this show. Of course, I keep thinking of the Rodgers and Hart musicals as the sitcoms of their day, because a lot of the ideas of the shows are as silly as, in the case of On Your Toes, the ballet russe had crisscrossed America, and the scandal was there were men naked to the waist.
Ooh la
so
la.
They thought, hey, let's do a musical about that.
That was then, this is now.
right, exactly. You know, and Babes in Arms, they, you know, Rodgers and Hart were walking through Central Park one day and they were watching a bunch of kids play together, and they were fascinated by the hierarchy that was being created among these kids and who was going to be the self-professed boss and stuff like that. And so they said, well, it would be fun to write a show about a bunch of kids trying to do something together. Mm. And, you know, out
hey,
of
let's
that,
put on a show.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And yet out of those rather forgettable plots came incredible songs. My Funny Valentine, Manhattan, Where or When, Ladies a Tramp. I mean, these are songs that are front and center in the American songbook.
They certainly are. We'd like to keep them that way. With people like Keith Lockhart, we will.
But it is true, though, that certainly Pal Joey, you can say, they're beginning to take on serious, more serious, darker sort of subjects. Basically speaking, even in the Rodgers and Hart musicals, the shows were an excuse for a lot of good songs to assemble.
Yeah, they were clearly not afraid of anything. So if somebody came up, as John O'Hara did, with the idea of this sort of anti-hero guy, it seems as if they were up for any story that interested them and would sort of get their creative juices going, and then they'd figure out, you know, what kind of songs would be appropriate to those characters.
Were they the smash hit pair of their day?
Yes, they were big hit writers. I mean, there were others who were successful in those days, the Gershwin brothers and Cole Porter and stuff, but they were certainly cranking out the musical comedies, and they were sort of the musical comedy hit guys of that era.
We're
We'll continue our conversation about Richard Rodgers in a moment. Let's go into the break with a Rodgers and Hart song called Mountain Greenery from the show The Garrick Gaieties of 1926, performed by Keith Lockhart and the Boston Pops. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ashbrook, this is On Point. On the 100th anniversary of his birth, we're celebrating the life and music of Richard Rodgers with Ted Chapin, president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, and Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops. Before our break, we were talking about Richard Rodgers' early years with lyricist Lorenz Hart. Here's the Rodgers and Hart song, It Never Entered My Mind.
I don't care if there's powder on my nose. I don't care if my hairdo is in place. I've lost the very meaning of repose. I never put a mud pack on my face. Oh, who'd have thought that I'd walk in a daze? Now I never go to shows at night, but just to matinees now. See the show and home I go.
How did that collaboration ultimately break up?
Well, Lorenz Hart was not a happy human being. He was gay at a time where that was not really spoken about or acceptable in any way, but I think he was also just a tortured human being. It's, of course, very easy to look at some of his lyrics and say, oh, look, there's the man speaking for himself, which is, I think, something dangerous. But he got to the point where it was harder for him to work. He used to refer to Rodgers as the school teacher, because Rodgers was a disciplinarian. He liked to go to the office at 10 o'clock and, you know, close the door and start working, and Larry Hart didn't like doing that.
Larry Hart was alcoholic. He was famous for this kind of jaundiced or jaunty cynicism.
Yeah, exactly. But he was also, from those who know him, you know, when he was on and up, he was the happiest and the most glorious fellow to be around. But when the gloom took over, it was pretty gloomy. And ironically, and kind of interesting transition, the Theater Guild had this idea of making a musical of Green Grow the Lilacs, a play they had produced, and they wanted Rodgers and Hart to do it. And Lorenz Hart read the play and said, I just don't, these cowboys.
Forget about it.
This isn't me.
And, of course, that turned into Oklahoma.
And Oklahoma, Keith Lockhart,
with a different collaborator.
That would be Oscar Hammerstein. And, of course, that set American musicals off on an entirely new path.
It was thought to be so profoundly different and so profoundly over-self-serious, I suppose, for a musical that people didn't think it had a chance. Where were the Ziegfeld Girls? Where was the glitter on the stage? It, however, I think when you look at Oklahoma, you're looking at a show which arguably is one of the very first where the songs are an integral part of the plot line, where it's really a concept musical from beginning to end. Some of the more forgettable plots of 10 years earlier, you could basically stick the same group of songs into any story whatsoever, and no matter how flimsy, and put it together. In this case, you have really well-defined characters who are defined in the narrative of the plot and also defined by the music that they take on. You have rather serious and dark elements in the play, obviously the sexual tension between Judd and Curly and those sorts of things. You have full-scale concept ballets. Agnes DeMille set the Oklahoma Dream Ballet. You have a whole different animal in terms of the total art statement of the musical as opposed to a lot of great songs in a fairly forgettable context.
But the farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. The cowman ropes a cow with ease. The farmer steals her butter and cheese. But that's no reason why they can't be friends.
Tear dry bones should stick together. Tear dry bones should all be found. Cowboys dance with the farmer's daughters. Farmers dance with the rancher's girls.
So this isn't Tin Pan Alley. This is something new.
No, I think so. Is Ted, would you say that's a...
I think that's extremely well stated. Rodgers once answered when someone said, well, you know, what it is about Oklahoma that's different from other shows. He said, well, you know, it is all of a piece, and the orchestrations have to sound the way the costumes look, which I think is kind of wonderful. Because
it's
some
a Gesamtkunstwerk, as Richard Wagner would have said. You know.
Right. You've got the seamless integration here, then, of song and dance and story and costumes, even.
Right, right. it does look, on one hand, like a pretty homespun story about some plain people. And I think a lot of people confuse what this revolution was. It doesn't look like a revolutionary musical. And I think, you know, everybody just said it was the first time where it all worked together. You know, there are bits and pieces in musicals before Oklahoma that had attempted to do elements of it, and some very experimental musicals. But it was Oklahoma that sort of did it all together and also got extraordinarily popular appeal. I mean, the folks loved it.
Let's talk about just one song, The Surrey with the Fringe on Top, of course, from Oklahoma. Keith Lockhart, it's on the Centennial album that the Boston Pops have put out. It's almost a one-note song, an old joke, but almost true, is it not?
Well, we were, I was just doing some counting on my fingers here, and only four of the first 18 notes are different. Four of the first 18 notes are different. He basically wrote a one-note song. It's like Johnny One Note written all over again.
You could almost play it with access to one key on the piano.
Ted, the story on this is that this is a music came first or music came second?
Mostly with the Hammerstein ones, the music came after the lyrics.
This was a big change from Rodgers and Hart, was it not?
Absolutely, the sea change.
With Hart, it would be the music first,
right,
and then they'd write the lyrics. Hammerstein would deliver the lyrics to Rodgers, and Rodgers would bring it to musical life.
It's interesting that Rodgers could shift in midstream like that. I would think that once somebody got into a habit of working in one way, that's a 180-degree phase shift.
Maybe that's part of the reason he could change the kind of theme and tone of his music as well, because he reversed his work style.
Yeah.
And he was constantly innovative. I mean, this song has the kind of ambling, clip-cloppy thing that you would expect to go along with a Surrey ride. And the fact that these things apparently just came to him, I guess he was an incredibly fast worker. Didn't Hammerstein say that Rodgers could have written, like, you know, 10 songs to his one or something like
that? Yeah, he said, once you hand Dick Rodgers a lyric, get out of his way. And he always defended it by saying that, you know, because they were shows and they had talked about the characters and the situation and where the song would be and kind of what the idea of the song would be, that by the time Hammerstein would hand him the lyrics, Rodgers would just go and say, oh yeah, okay, here's the music for those words.
Mm-hmm.
So with Hart, there's this notion of more ingenious music, maybe fresher. But
well, younger. They were younger.
Okay, fair enough. With Hammerstein, it becomes this full-bodied, fully sentimental music with a focus on moral uplift, even.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that Oscar Hammerstein was, sentimental is a tough word because I don't want people
it's
to cringe
a negative connotation to some extent.
Yeah.
About it.
What's negative here?
I was thinking the word sentimental, we think cloying.
But let's be fair. I mean, you can't avoid sentimentality in Rodgers and Hammerstein,
right,
can you? I mean,
no.
That is a fundamental, maybe the core of this music.
But I will defend it only in that it's emotionally accurate for the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that if he sees somebody who, you know, in Carousel will write, you'll never walk alone. And if you see Carousel, you realize exactly why that character is saying that sentiment at that point. Take it out of the show completely and just give it to a choir, and it's hard to say it's not sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, though, looking at Lawrence Hart's lyrics, as a lyricist, his lyrics have such bite. They're so intelligent, so witty. I have a particular admiration for how he could turn a phrase. And the ideas, I mean, I didn't know what time it was till I met
oh,
you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's just
fantastically subtle. And then in Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, of course, it's sung by a mature woman who's keeping a young gigolo. And she sings, vexed again, perplexed again. Thank God I can be
oversexed
again. This is mature, grown-up stuff.
Yeah, and I probably got a couple of gasps in the 1930s on Broadway.
Oh, and we have the alternate lyrics that were written then so the radios wouldn't play them.
Right.
I'll sing to her each spring to her and long for the day when I'll cling to her bewitched, bothered and bewildered. I'm all
talk to us, Ted Chapin about Richard Rodgers' personality, and was he a chameleon? What face did he show to the world, to his family, to his friends?
Well, I think first and foremost, he lived for his art. I mean, he was happiest when he was composing or he was sitting in a theater when a show was being put on. I mean, I don't think you can write shows from 1926 to 1979 and not like what you're doing. So I think that even Dorothy Rodgers once said to me when I first got to the office that she knew she was number two in his life, that his work was number one, and she just had to accept that. And I think that he was capable of great humor, but he was also capable of quite stern outlook on life. There are a couple of pictures of him listening to music, and it's a pretty stern look on his face.
We read that he had the demeanor of a banker.
Yes, well.
And at the same time, he was depressive, he was alcoholic, he was a womanizer.
Well,
even
finally,
though,
yes. Finally, the book has been written that tells all the good stuff like that.
Stuff, you know? Well, is that wrong?
Well, no. I mean, I didn't know him, and I think that obviously, you know, that has been written about in this book that came out this year, and both of his daughters have explained that. And I think their defense was simply that this was part of him that probably was suppressed in his lifetime, and why not tell the whole story so people who are interested can see what this particular creative person was all about.
Well, the beauty of telling the whole story is that then we appreciate the kind of grandeur and beauty of his work all the more. Even people who are not always dancing up on their toes can create that incredible body of uplifting work.
Exactly. And you know, Mary Rodgers has said, and I think she's been sort of misinterpreted, that what she feels her father left her is the same kind of thing he left the rest of us, this wonderful music.
Keith Lockhart, walk us forward with Rodgers and Hammerstein from Oklahoma. What's the terrain of their progress?
Well, the terrain of their progress is, considering how important their work is in the canon of the American musical theater, it's a rather short run. It's 15 years. You go from Oklahoma to Carousel, and then from Carousel to South Pacific.
Right. And you skip over Allegro.
Yes, there are a couple of the shows that nobody knows very well. There's Allegro, there's Flower Drum Song, there's Sweet Thursday is from
Pipe Dream.
Pipe Dream, that's yes. But there are six shows that people practically know every word of.
Hammerstein was determined to bring big issues into musical theater. He wanted to address racial issues. He wanted to talk about world peace and a kind of love conquers all sense of humanity. This was new, was it not?
I think very much so. And like I said, when you think of concept shows these days, I mean, Stephen Sondheim comes to mind, people who are using the musical to express bigger issues than some people may think it's seemly to express in song. But I think his legacy is very clear. And he was a fairly direct protege of Oscar Hammerstein's.
And was this pair, Rodgers, Hammerstein, overtly political? Were they received as political at the time when South Pacific came out, for example? There was a lot of attention paid there. I mean, I guess first of all, there was a fresh interpretation of World War II, and there was a lot of attention paid to race. How did that hit the public at the time?
They embraced South Pacific in a way that none of the other shows were quite as embraced in their day, because it is interesting that it was based on Michener's book about World War II experiences, and it came out in 1949, a short time after the war. It was also the first show that Rodgers and Hammerstein did after Allegro, which was a flop, so they needed it to be a hit. And Michener told the story of You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, the most overtly political in that whole show. And everybody said, the show is wonderful, cut the song, it's too preachy. And Rodgers and Hammerstein said, no, that's what the show's about, so we're not going to cut that song. It's also not a very long song, but it's a very strong statement.
You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught.
I wonder, did Rodgers or Rodgers and Hammerstein create the kind of mid and late 20th century American sense of itself, or reflect it?
I would say they reflect it. I think it's tough for artists in the musical theater to steer somebody in a course. I think that it's better in a reflective thing, and I think that they were very much, you know, men of their period. And, you know, they cared about this country. And Rodgers was not a very political guy. Hammerstein was more political. He was very much involved with the New World Federalists and wrote some speeches for Adlai Stevenson and stuff like that. But also, you know, the 50s was a time where, you know, the artists who were very political were very obvious. I mean, the communist scare period made a lot of people very skittish. Mm.
In D-Day, which you have on the My Favorite Things album, Keith Lockhart, we have a Rodgers piece that was composed not with Hart or Hammerstein, but his own, and this is more symphonic approach here. Why did you choose it? It's pretty well outside what the public well knows. And what's it say to you?
Well, it was important, like I said, first and foremost, this is what we do, our orchestral albums. There are many, many collections of Richard Rodgers songs already on the market. And it was important for us to come up with the best standalone statements that Rodgers had done for orchestra. That's why Carousel Waltz, and that's why Slaughter on 10th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And that's also why his really, except for those couple of small things for Paul Whiteman, it's really one of the few things that he wrote that was not ever intended for theatrical consumption, and that is for the first, for Victory at Sea, which was the first TV docudrama from, what, 1952, 1953?
53, I think.
53, and was hours and hours of music that he wrote. He was commissioned to do it and immediately engaged Robert Russell Bennett, whom we talked about before, as his orchestrator. Mm. And the two of them created a score that stands symphonically very well on its own. That particular selection that we used is not one of the more commonly known selections, but having played through the entirety of the score, we found that we thought it was one of the most musically compelling. One of the things that was most of a cogent musical statement by itself. It's really a long theme and variations form. It's really, so it resembles a serious concert sort of composition more than most of the things that Richard Rodgers wrote.
Heard D-Day in a vacuum, do you think you'd recognize it as a Rodgers composition?
No, actually, I don't. I might recognize it as a Robert Russell Bennett orchestration, because mm-hmm. he has a very distinctive sound that really ties into kind of what we think of in 50s movie scores. But in terms of Richard Rodgers, no. I mean, because, like I said, he's a theater composer. I expect words attached to his stuff.
How do we see Rodgers, and I guess Rodgers and Hammerstein, or Hart, echoing down through later composers and lyricists? Do you see their fingerprints on music that followed?
Well, the other person who kind of interestingly speaks about Rodgers a lot is Andrew Lloyd Webber, and you know, in a funny way, he doesn't write with one lyricist, but he writes music of a certain style. And Steve Sondheim, in a way, Sondheim took Hammerstein and went in one direction, and Andrew Lloyd Webber took Rodgers and went in a slightly other direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep saying to the younger generation of writers, study what Rodgers and Hammerstein did, because the construction of these shows is extraordinary. And if you want to figure out how the machinery works, study these shows, because they're absolutely astonishing that way. And I think the fact that Sondheim learned that from Hammerstein does show, you know, because on the one hand, you know, he wanted to write shows that were structured in a way the way Hammerstein shows were, and then he wanted to go somewhere completely different.
We'll be back with more of our conversation about Richard Rodgers. Let's go into the break with My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music, performed by the Boston Pops and country singer Martine McBride from the new CD My Favorite Things, a Richard Rodgers celebration.
And then I don't feel so bad.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the centenary of his birth, we're celebrating the life and music of Richard Rodgers with Ted Chapin, president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, and Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops. This is the overture from Rodgers and Hammerstein's first smash hit, Oklahoma. Ted Chapin, talk about the overture with us for a minute. How did Rodgers think about the overture? What was it, just knitting everything together in one great calico? What was he trying to accomplish when he set about laying out the overture?
Well, my suspicion, although it's not terribly well documented how those overtures came together, is a combination of setting the tone. I mean, the great Rodgers and Hammerstein overtures, where the chords at the beginning of The King and I tell you everything you need to know. You know, the violins at the beginning of Oklahoma, it places you where you need to go. But I also think they wanted to feature the tunes that you're going to hear. It's interesting that in the Rodgers and Hart era, you know, sometimes the featured tunes in the overture did not turn out to be the hit tunes in the show.
There's the great example of that, of course, is that in Babes in Arms, they left out My Funny Valentine from the overture, which
and
turned
that
out
survived
to be
fairly
the one
well.
That survived better than any of the other well-known tunes from it.
And it starts with that great tune, All at Once.
Right. Baby needs attention to grow at once in the right direction.
Very good.
Thank you. You know, it really is. I think there is a commercial need there. Especially in the days when a show was kind of a flop if there wasn't at least one or two songs from it that had an independent life as a hit song. Mm-hmm. That's not so much the case these days. I mean, you can count on the fingers of one hand the songs that have come out of a show. One Night in Bangkok from Chess would be one example. Send in the Clowns from A Little Night Music. But it's not commonplace anymore. But at that point, there was a matter of they had to make their best guess as to which ones the public would pick up on and reinforce those songs. So the public did really leave the theater whistling those tunes.
Ted, what was Richard Rodgers' sense of himself and his place in musical history? What would he think of the kind of celebration that's going on around his own centennial?
Well, I think he would like it. I would certainly hope he would like it. He would always have a comment about the tempo if it was too fast. But I think, you know, he would be thrilled. He would be very opinionated. I mean, his daughters are both very opinionated, which I find kind of amusing. That's where I think he comes, you know, you can see him through them. And it's great. They'll just love something. And then sometimes I'm sitting next to one of them in the theater, and I get a steely stare.
Prune face.
And you know that one of his daughters grew up to be a recognized Broadway composer in her own right, Mary Rodgers, including Once Upon a Mattress. What are the other?
Well, The Mad Show off Broadway, she wrote, and then Freaky Friday, which was made into a film that had not a composer, but as a
children's book writer.
Right.
And then his grandson. Uh-huh. Adam Gettle is one of the new, most exciting of the new generation of Broadway composers. So there's a legacy that's directly, you know, biologically related to Richard Rodgers.
It keeps on rolling. The Rodgers and Hammerstein partnership ended on an incredible high note in terms of popularity and sales in The Sound of Music. What was the story of that final collaboration?
Well, Mary Martin brought to Rodgers and Hammerstein the idea of the story of the Von Trapp family that she was going to do as a play and use a couple of the songs that the Von Trapp family actually sang when they toured. But they felt that they needed a couple of other songs, you know, to help. And Rodgers and Hammerstein looked at this and said, listen, we think this should be a whole score, but we're writing for our drum song. If you can wait for a year, we'll do that for you, Mary. And so that she said, okay. So they did the Flower Drum Song, and then they all started to work on The Sound of Music. Halfway through it was discovered that Hammerstein was not well. Mm-hmm. So it was his last score. And in fact, interesting.
He had cancer, right?
Yeah, he had cancer. Mm-hmm. And he died 6 months after it opened. In an interview that I heard fairly recently, somebody had sent me a tape, and I just happened to listen to it recently. When asked the question, which came first, words or music, Rodgers said with Hammerstein it was always lyrics first, except in a couple of times, like Edelweiss, which was their last song they ever wrote together. It was written in Boston when The Sound of Music was out of town, and he said Hammerstein wasn't well enough, so I wrote the melody, and then he came up to Boston and finished and wrote the lyric.
Well.
Blossom of snow, may you bloom and grow, bloom and grow forever. Edelweiss, bless my homeland forever.
How did Richard Rodgers take the loss of his second great partner?
Well, pretty strong. I mean, either one of the collaborations would have given him a place in the history, and, you know, to have outlived two of them. I mean, it is kind of amazing that, you know, what did he do? He just looked for another show and dove right back in and wrote No Strings, which is a, you know, show for which he wrote his own lyrics.
You know, it kind of strikes me as interesting. His life divides itself up so evenly by his collaborators. It's almost exactly 15, 16 years with Lorenz Hart, right? At least in terms of the Broadway period, 26 to 41, 42. And Hammerstein from 43 to 58. And himself and a variety of others.
Right.
A huge variety of others, actually. He never came up with that one partner for the rest of his creative life.
Keith Lockhart, as a musician, as a conductor, how do you think this music of Richard Rodgers will be seen in another 100 years? When, I guess to the extent that we can look back to the earliest recorded music, and some of it sounds now very plunky and plinky and dated, do you think Rodgers will recede in that? Or in the age when everything is recorded and endlessly played and kind of morphs along with us, will it stay forever part of what Americans listen to in a present tense way?
I don't know. It's so hard to, you know, if we were having this interview 100 years ago.
2102 or 1902.
There are very, very few songs which were central to people's life experiences at that point that you can point to now, you know, maybe Stephen Foster songs, but very few of them that have survived an entire century still being not just curiosities and novelties. So I think it would be extremely arrogant of me, or at least to even guess. I will say that the great thing about songs like these is that they've entered the bloodstream of Americans and people around the world, and they've also entered the bloodstream of performers. And one of the great things about Rodgers' songs is the versatility, is the fact that many of these songs have become jazz standards. And, you know, name a jazz vocalist who doesn't know, you know, My Funny Valentine or Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered. They've been taken on by pop artists with great success. That kind of ensures their viability more than if they were confined to just a life in the theater.
Keith Lockhart, conductor for the Boston Pops, thanks for being with us this hour.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Ted Chapin, president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops' new CD is called My Favorite Things, a Richard Rodgers celebration. To continue the conversation about Richard Rodgers, go to our website at onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, we'll review the week's events with our news analyst, Jack Beatty. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of the week.
Peace requires a new and different Palestinian leadership so that a Palestinian state can be born. I call on the Palestinian people to elect new leaders. Leaders not compromised by terror.
President Arafat officially declares today that the elections of the President of the Palestinian Authority and the election of the Palestinian Legislative Council will be held on January 2003. The date will be between the 10th and the 20th.
Just as the Supreme Court has recognized that elected officials may invoke God's blessing on their work, as we do here every day, and as in the House chamber they have over the Speaker's chair in God We Trust, for our children to be allowed to invoke God's blessing on our country in the Pledge of Allegiance certainly is something that we would want to do.
I am confident that we will be able to avoid a shutdown of services. We have much more work to do, but we will continue to work on an effective solution that resolves Amtrak's financial problems.
WorldCom may be down, but the company says it's not out yet. The telecommunications firm says it still has a long-term future despite growing speculation that bankruptcy is just around the corner. Analysts say the company's admission that executives hid almost $4 billion in operating expenses to inflate earnings will prevent WorldCom from getting a new line of credit that it desperately needs.
Corporate America has got to understand there's a higher calling than trying to fudge the numbers. Kind of try to slip a billion here or a billion there and may hope nobody notices. That you have a responsibility in this country to to always be above board.
There's no place for the fire to mount an assault and make a run at Sholo. If we get the winds, we may get some spotting into Sholo.
As the legal proceedings continue for an indefinite period into the future, I must make a decision regarding my political future today and the city of Providence. After a great deal of personal reflection, I will not seek re-election as mayor.
Kananaskis will be remembered as an extremely important summit where we have acted collectively to make sure that globalization benefit all the citizens of the globe and that no continent should be left behind.
And there's the week President Bush finally speaks up. His big speech on the Middle East, Palestinians announce that they will hold elections in January. The Pledge of Allegiance takes a hit. Senator Trent Lott and many other politicians come back strongly supporting it. Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta says they'll keep Amtrak running, but who knows how long. WorldCom becomes the latest corporation hit hard by accounting scandal. President Bush takes uncharacteristic aim at big business with tough words. The town of Sholo, Arizona, looks like it will be spared the massive fires in the West. But is he antsy? Providence mayor says he will not seek re-election after being convicted of racketeering conspiracy. And Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien at the G8 summit near Calgary says that the Group of Eight will line up behind Africa. Jack Beattie, there is a sound of gears turning in the news these days, of significant changes going on in the view toward corporate America, in the American posture toward the Middle East. These are not minor tweaks that we're seeing.
No, I think there's a pre-political ambivalence about the corporation that people are experiencing. Just a few months ago, Enron, only 1% of the people thought that was an important issue. But I think drip by drip, people are beginning to understand that there's something systemically wrong here, whether it's with the pliant boards or, bankers who are in the tank or lawyers. It's hard to put your finger on the one cause, but there clearly is something badly out of whack. And, Kevin Phillips in his new book says that this kind of thing that has produced political alignments, realignments in the past, the growing public anger over these kinds of sort of ripoffs help to bring about political change. But it's hard to see that happening, at least now.
But a pre-political ambivalence suggesting, Jack Beattie, that this may turn into political wildfire of some kind, and President Bush clearly smelling that possibility this week with his tough statements on big business. But he's, on policy terms, he's no Teddy Roosevelt yet.
No, he's not, and it's welcome statements that he's making. His vice president at Halliburton, they had their own issue with when he was the chief executive officer of that company. They had their own issue with accounting disputed, and the president has not increased the budget of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he's just appointed the guy, the man who developed the sort of regulatory black hole for Enron. He's just appointed him to some regulatory body. So his words are saying one thing, and his actions, with the exception of the Anderson indictment, that a lot of people were surprised that the Bush administration essentially wrecked a company.
That is very real. On the Mideast front, incredibly divergent views in response to the president's speech, with the conservatives applauding it as bedrock brilliant and others saying this is utterly naive or worse.
Yeah, the Jerusalem Post, quoting from Israelis of all stripes, saying Prime Minister Sharon could have written the speech. Everyone concedes that even probably in his own moments, Prime Minister Sharon, that he has no solution. And so the president has just given a speech that the prime minister would have given. So reinforcing the idea that there's no solution in that path. All along the idea has been you got to give the Palestinians a political dimension, some hope. Hard to see it here, at least in the short run.
One nation under God, Jack.
With liberty and justice for all. Tom, you have a great time.
Have a great weekend.
All right.
On Point, senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...